Hello, and due to a, well, let's call it a technical snafu, the archives from CFRU aren't available right now, so we don't have last week's complete episode here for you to listen right this moment. But since we recorded the interview we did in advance, in a pre-tape, we do have that available, and we wanted to share it. It was a very good interview. Even though the rest of the show was about the NDP leadership race and Doug Ford getting back into politics, even though we don't have those available, the interview we felt was still very, very good, and we want to share that because we do like to share these things and these interviews that we do. It's very important. So we're going to proceed this week with a abbreviated version of Open Sources Guelph and just present the interview we did with Professor Martin Holland from the Landscape Architecture Department of the University of Guelph. To set this up briefly, he was born and raised in Halifax, and he went to grad school in Charlottesville, Virginia, which have been two of the hotbeds for the statue debate, as in the racist implications of some of these statues and these figures in these towns. In the case of Halifax, Edward Cornwallis, and in the case of Charlottesville, Virginia, Robert E. Lee. So his insights are very interesting. He's lived in both cities, and I think it is very insightful in terms of what it's like on the ground there and what it was like in the years before this all broke out and all these discussions started taking place about the significance of these statues and what it means to minorities and groups who have felt subjugated by our white ancestors. So I will throw it to Martin Holland and the interview we did a couple of weeks back after our very familiar theme music. Martin Holland, you grew up in Halifax, which is now one hotbed of this statue debate.
Absolutely.
And then you for grad school, you made your way to Charlottesville, Virginia, which is another hotbed of statue debate.
I bring trouble wherever I go.
I was going to ask, how did you get so lucky?
Well, you know, I was really fortunate. So I did my undergraduate degree in philosophy at Dalhousie University, mm-hmm. Became interested in environmental ethics, and from there really made the transition into thinking about the built environment, and that's where I got into landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. So that's what I studied at the University of Virginia, and I lived basically two blocks away from where the statue of Robert E. Lee was downtown. So mm-hmm. At the time, it was really kind of inert. Not the same level of discourse, not the politically charged people in the streets. And it was just more this kind of benign, almost neglected space that was this gesture back to the Civil War. So it wasn't by any stretch of the imagination as politically charged as it is today.
Well, that's the thing, is it's sort of come up quite quickly, and you could say the same about Cornwallis and Halifax as well, right. That either the political circumstances have changed because, you know, certain people have been elected in certain positions, or maybe that just galvanized the situation and people found voice, because that was one of the things I was wondering about is this statue of Robert E. Lee, it's centralized. It's right there downtown in a park. You know, people must have walked past it two, three times a day, every day for 30, 40 years.
Absolutely. The thing that's really interesting about the majority of those Civil War monuments and statues is that if you look back on them, you know, it's really hard for the untrained eye to say, like, oh, these were erected immediately after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, in fact, the vast majority of statues and memorials to the Civil War, especially in the South, so south of the Mason-Dixon line, were built between, let's say, 1910 to almost as late as like 1950. So this is really almost 60 years after the end of the Civil War in the States. And in turn, they were created for very political reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to kind of walk through and think like, oh, this is a kind of a statue that is a gesture back to someone's heritage. Like, that's how the alt-right kind of frames it. Like, mm-hmm. we can't take these down. These are part of our own heritage or history.
Not even necessarily the alt-right, even just, you know, people who've
And you're basically, you know, you're kind of ignorant. You're ignorant of the history of it. And they were constructed for a very political purpose, right, as a way of asserting kind of white privilege in the public sphere. So it's a difficult, these are difficult issues, right, with regards to kind of race, identity, and the role of memory in terms of how a society remembers certain events. I think the problem starts to emerge when you have communities, you know, African-American communities, for instance, in this example, who they don't need to be reminded. They're very, right. very cognizant of the kind of violence and white terror that was inflicted upon their communities. And they probably have their own personal connection to loss and violence.
Yeah.
So that's when you start to have this like debate between should these come down? Should they get removed? Should they be reinterpreted? How do you deal with this in the public sphere in a modern, hopefully integrated and egalitarian society? And I think you're starting to see those fracture points really be articulated, especially now after the election of November 2016.
The historical argument is, it's a popular one because I think it's a safe one. But your point is valid, though, that, you know, if you are black in the South or even anywhere in the United States, you do not need to be reminded of the heritage of racism.
You do not. I mean, you just have to look at the Constitution. The original Constitution is, you know, you're three-fifths of a human being. So there's a legacy, a deep, deep-rooted legacy of racism in the United States. And the struggle is that we like to think, and again, I lived down there for 20 years, you like to think that you're post-racial, right? So the reference back to President Obama, all of a sudden, this was supposed to magically erase, you know, centuries of racism to say like, oh, we were able to elect an African-American president. And I think instead what's happened is that was an articulation, his presidency. All of a sudden now, if you look at the Trump administration, they're going through and trying to, like, line by line erase what all the policies and the achievements of the Obama administration, which is unheard of in American history for a president to do. So it is a very safe heritage kind of argument, but it does have implications for how we view and inhabit public space.
I called the Trump presidency basically the Costanza policy, whereas if everything Barack Obama did was wrong, the opposite is correct.
Yeah.
But you can't ignore, and you know, this probably comes from white privilege, the fact that people can't ignore, first of all, the post-racial thing. There was the dramatic increase in racism, especially after his second election. While at the same time, a lot of those same people were saying, no, it's not about race, it's about him being bad.
It is difficult to be able to parse that difference.
Yeah.
And it's really incredibly disheartening to see what's going on down there right now.
I would agree. So being in and around Charlottesville, and you know, when you were a student, you presumably were living and working alongside of people of color, and Virginia has a very very big black population, obviously. What was the undercurrent there? Were they like the white students, you know, they're just ignoring Robert E. Lee sitting on horseback on the hill? Or was there like even occasionally rumblings like, you know what, I really don't like Robert E. Lee sitting there looking at me?
You know, there were instances, it was funny, my wife actually noticed this before I did.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is American, she's from California. So we moved, you know, I'm getting settled to go to into my master's program, and we're kind of a stone's throw away from like a McDonald's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
We don't normally frequent there, but it just so happened, like, we're desperate, we just moved, we needed to get breakfast. So we go and we walk into this McDonald's, and it was instantaneous that there was a white side and an African-American side.
Really?
And they knew one another. These are the kind of the seniors that go for like the cheap coffee, and it's a social time for them. It's early in the morning, you know, probably around 7:30. And it was amazing because they were incredibly familiar and actually almost fond of this of each other. They knew each other's histories. They knew their families. And yet
they were self-segregating.
They were self-segregating. And so going on, I think one of the dangers of living in a university town is that you're surrounding yourself by people who often are, you know, more progressive. So I never experienced that on campus. We had a diverse student population at the time. Mm. There were issues that would come up every once in a while about issues of race and about representation or economic kind of opportunities. But really, for the most part, if you were in that safe bubble of being on campus, everything was fine.
Mm.
It wouldn't take much, though. And I remember driving to Richmond, right? So the Confederacy capital, right? And kind of getting turned around, back road in kind of central Virginia. And then all of a sudden you're starting to see the Confederate flag being flown. And it's really easy to dismiss seeing that as saying like, oh, well, these are, you know, these are kind of, they're not really well-educated, or they're rednecks, or, you know, whatever kind of derogatory term, like kind of shrug your shoulders and it's like, you know, people are going to be like that. But what we saw in Charlottesville just recently was that then you start to see people that all of a sudden you're like, I had no idea that you harbored or have this belief system. They're well-educated, they're well-employed. So, like, the argument that this is an economic class that's been disenfranchised doesn't seem to hold anymore. So I feel like it's suddenly the context has changed that allows, like, it was suddenly, somehow, it's suddenly acceptable to be racist in public. And that's the thing that my wife and I were watching what was happening in Charlottesville, and we were just mortified, you know, getting this kind of Twitter stream and seeing what was going on. So my experience, and this is back from like 1999 to 2002, really, I think that those strands of racism were still very, very strong, but they were hidden from our kind of from our perception.
I think there's also a factor of people not maybe knowing that they're racist. If you know, if you can know you're racist, I found a Twitter thread from a young woman, a young black woman, who was a counselor at a summer camp. She was going to college the next fall, so this was kind of her summer job. But it was a predominantly white summer camp, and all the other counselors were white. And she's talking about how she's going to college and she's studying this, and they're like, "Oh yeah, well, when you're black, you get to college, you go to go to college for free." Oh yeah, and there's just this sort of this mode of thinking that you wouldn't classify as racist because it isn't we hate black people, but it's this sort of this element of disinformation that when you're black, the government has made it so that it's so easy for you that you get free college and you get free health care
free cell phones. I mean, yeah, there's a period in the States where it's like, oh, you can get an Obama phone. It's like, whoa, where's this coming from? So the legacy of Ronald Reagan and his designer, welfare queens and designer jeans, it played into the stereotype that unfortunately seems to be so interwoven with the American experience that somehow the people that are actually doing the hard physical labor and work that no one else seems to actually want to do then gets labeled as being lazy. So, for instance, the appointment that I had before I came up here to the University of Guelph, I was working at Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina. Its history is quite amazing because it was originally a slave plantation. So this is a university whose very origin is based on slavery.
Right.
And when you have a student docent giving you a tour on campus, back in the 1950s and 60s, they were very clearly using the word plantation. This is the Fort Hill Plantation.
Right.
Now that's been removed. So a student docent talks about, well, this is the Fort Hill Complex. And even though the very purpose of how this was donated to become an institution of higher learning is based on kind of agricultural college. So it's very similar in the sense of like its purpose as the University of Guelph. But the people that were actually doing the physical labor were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
It moved from that to sharecroppers. So again, you know, economically disadvantaged, inherently unfair situation.
Right.
Once that was changed in the 1950s, it was not uncommon for them to have wards of the state, or actually at that time they were called slaves of the state, which were African-American prisoners who were then working on this campus. And this is, I mean, this is really, really late. This is in the 1950s. So the experience of slavery is so intertwined with so many educational institutions in the United States in terms of endowments, where the properties were actually were held. I know at Princeton University, part of the college, some of the rooms actually had the slave quarters. University of Virginia is another great example. So you have this academical center, right? The lawn, this kind of World Heritage Site recognized by UNESCO.
Mm.
But adjacent to that were slave quarters for basically this, the very wealthy, privileged white students. And it's like, here's, you know, here are my attendants, here are my slaves to actually help me live and function as a student. It's crazy.
That's so incredible to think about, that you go to college and
you take
your slave with you.
Yeah.
My goodness. The thing that I take from that is it's an extension of this debate now, that they're taking people like you on a tour of campus and they're, I'm not sure if I want to use the term, but I'll use it anyway, whitewashing the fact that this was a plantation. And we're facing that same debate now with what to do about these statues and whether removing them is whitewashing history or whether, you know, should, you know, the ugliness be right there in front of you, even though as we've discussed, the intention wasn't that we're honoring Robert E. Lee, great hero of the Confederacy, or even, you know, his own legacy as a soldier for the Union before secession. But it's difficult because I recognize in the case of the plantation, you know, you probably don't want to walk around campus especially if you're a black student, and say, yeah, this used to be the plantation. But you should recognize that maybe the positivity of this used to be a place where people were subjugated. Now it is a place where all people can come and learn.
I mean, so part of my own take, and this is something that I've struggled with in terms about like the legacy of these statues, and is that they do provide an example that you can actually learn from, right? Mm. So In the case of for Clemson and thinking about the presence of you know, a black or African American student on campus, here's an opportunity to say, here is how far we've actually come from those kind of situations. The real difficulty is that you start to look and say, okay, I can see the statues of Robert E. Lee, I can see the statues of John C. Calhoun, for instance. But where are the African-American statues, right? So these are, whether we want to talk about it or not, they're often racialized. So I know the controversy that happened in Washington, D.C. with the Martin Luther King statue and Maya Angelou kind of calling to the Parks Commission to task for the quote that was edited for content purposes, but it ended up making Martin Luther King look a little bit, I think her exact term was a twit. but, you know, that's a statue that you can at least turn to and say, here is the presence of an African-American within this kind of memorial or ceremonial civic space that shows who we are now. And we're looking back and we're honoring him. And to say, like, we have made this kind of progress. So the difficulty is, you know, to me, these statues can actually have a dialogue between themselves once they're erected that can start to influence and actually have this kind of intent of, like, all right, what were the different periods of time that they were constructed? Why were they built? Who paid for them? All of these kind of issues that start to reveal a really kind of complicated social and economic history, and also start to reframe kind of the context and understanding about who we are today. And I think that that's the other dilemma, is that really we don't do these kind of statues anymore. In fact, if you look at kind of memorial trends, they're becoming more and more kind of larger landscapes, right? And kind of environments that you kind of immersed yourself into. And they're almost always kind of therapeutic, right? So if you go back to the 1980s with Myelin's Vietnam, Vietnam War Memorial, again, it's not any figurative. That was part of an addition that had to be, that was part of the compromise in order to get this built.
Right.
But that very beautiful, powerful memorial at the time, again, hugely controversial. In fact, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, why would we build this? I mean, this is a memorial to the losers.
Right.
So to me, to think about these Civil War statues is like, how can you kind of recontextualize them? How can you reframe them so that they still have an educational purpose, and yet they show and reflect the values that we have today? And I think that's the critical debate that needs to happen. And it has to be more than just like, you know, do they stay or do they go?
That's a great point about the Vietnam Memorial, because I've been in thinking this about my own life. It's like, well, why would you want to have a statue of Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson? They, you know, you don't get participation trophies when you lose the war.
Right.
But Vietnam is an example of that. But I think the difference is the Vietnam Memorial isn't contextualized as a the Civil War statue, certainly. It's like, yeah, but the South will rise again. We lost the war, but the South will rise again. The Vietnam, no one's saying, you know, we're going to go to Vietnam and finish what we started.
Well, that's why you have Rambo movies, right? That's why you go back and because those are the fictions of, like, we never lost the war. Or even more importantly, it wasn't the soldiers that lost the war.
Right.
This was government and, you know, bungling, right? We're never meant to. Like, that's the narrative that then gets kind of put out there.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, for all of the rise of these Civil War statues, they were coming at a time where it's really about this new trend, and it was called like the tragic loss cause of the Confederacy.
Right.
Where all of a sudden it's not about slavery anymore.
Right.
That is taken off the table. This was about the noble struggle, right? And it's the war of the northernly aggression, right? So that's how they frame it in the South. This is not the Civil War. This is the war of the North, northerly aggression. And it was a way of highlighting heritage, and that this was a noble cause, that people were coming to, this was a democratic action, and we did our very best, but we were still defeated. But in that sacrifice, we were remaining true to our beliefs.
Right.
So it does cover this notion of slavery, about these really horrific, horrific conditions that really they wanted to basically ignore, so it could reframe themselves much more within the kind of context of, like, we did our absolute best, but it wasn't meant to be.
And then history repeats itself, because they plaster over the racism. And then we saw that, to go back to what we were talking about with the election of Barack Obama, the racism was plastered over. And it wasn't about him being black. It was about him being wrong.
Right.
And without addressing the reasons why you think he is wrong.
Well, and then it started, you know, the birther movement.
So right.
Like, oh, well, he's not actually even qualified to be.
Right.
So let's investigate his, you know, his birth certificate. And he's actually Kenyan. So, and then the odd thing is then you hear about Ted Cruz, right?
Yeah.
So you're like, how, again, these double standards that start to appear. And it's amazing to see how much that breaks along racial lines.
I do want to revisit Halifax before
we
sign off. We kind of got stuck at Charlottesville. But I realize, you know, it's been a while since you lived there.
Right.
But I wonder how much of we've learned from, you know, in the modern context and recontextualizing people like Edward Cornwallis.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a kid, was that past, that ugly past of his, ever talked about?
No. I mean, I had a pretty good rate of attending all my classes, right? You have to if you're going to become a university professor. It's just the thing that you kind of do. We never talked about that. And so to me, again, the statue presents a opportunity to understand a historical figure in the context of their times.
Right.
I don't want to be an apologist for Cornwallis. That's the last thing that I want to do. But to me, it also provides a location where peaceful civic protest can happen, where dialogue can happen, where hopefully, if this is a debate that, whether it's city council or this larger kind of debate happens, about how do you handle the immediate surroundings about that statue? Is it recontextualized? Are there other indigenous leaders that could be recognized that could be also have a physical presence there through statuary? Or maybe it's even something like as a reinterpretation of the actual grounds where it's a return back to that time period. So let's maybe think about redesigning this as a location that reflects the ecosystems and the value systems of the indigenous people of the Mi'kmaq to reflect their values at that time. So then it's like all of a sudden you're entering a very different space from the urban fabric of Halifax, and you know that it's different. And here's this kind of historical figure, but in a very different kind of immediate physical context. And I'm hoping that those are the things that start to help people realize that he is a historical figure and that he is complicated and there is violence that is part of his history. And how we deal with that is a reflection on us. It's not a reflection on him.
And once again, that was Martin Holland, a landscape architecture professor at the University of Guelph. He also did an interview with one of the people in the communications department of the university. You can find that interview online at the University of Guelph website at uoguelph.ca. And to wrap things up, I will give our usual connections. OpenSourcesGuelph.com is our website. @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and Open Sources Newswire on Facebook is where you can find us, and you can download this episode and all the others on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find out more about my work at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. You can also go to Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and of course I co-host End Credits on CFRU Thursdays at 10 a.m. for a movie news and review show. Feel free to check that out, and there are past episodes of that on the Guelph Politicast channel. For more of Scotty Hertz, you can find him at Scotty Hertz on Facebook and Twitter, and you can go to his blog at thespannerbook.wordpress.com. And of course, you can listen to Open Sources Guelph live every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca. And hopefully we'll have these complete episodes back again for you soon. Thanks a lot.